the transition period between end of the Second Temple period, Bar Kokhba uprising, and the real beginnings of a diaspora. Okay, we're really going to spread out throughout the world, no more centralized authority in the land of Israel. Before we get to that, I wanted to spend a couple more minutes talking about Christianity, not the theology of Christianity, the historical connection, but just a little bit about the Jewish-Christian interaction and what happens in the Roman world when Christianity becomes a major world religion. Yeah. Yes. Okay, here we go. Okay. So I mentioned last class, we talked about how Christianity goes from a splinter sect of Judaism, right? Then Paul comes along, great marketing technique, removes observance of the commandments, says, replaces it with belief in JC, and therefore opens up the religion to the pagan world. And as I mentioned, for the first several centuries of the Common Era, it's a persecuted sect by the Roman authorities. And then in the 4th century, we talked about around 312, Constantine, the Roman emperor, issues his Edict of Toleration. He's the same emperor who, by the way, creates the capital, the new capital of Rome in the east, in Constantinople, which will later split into Eastern and Western Roman empires. Then we talked about 324, Council of Nicaea, when the early church fathers try and actually put together what Christianity is all about and all the different debates, the nature of JC, Son of God, Father, Son, that stuff, who's stronger than whom, all that interesting stuff. And then by 380, during Theodosius' reign, we have that Christianity is made the official religion of the Roman Empire, and we see a major revolution, so to speak, in the evolution, spiritual evolution of the world. Now, I know from a Jewish perspective, it's a little uncomfortable saying these things, you know, spiritual revolution. As I mentioned last week, Maimonides talks about the purpose of Christianity and Islam. Obviously, from our perspective, as I said before, we should have done it directly. We should have elevated the whole world to not all becoming Jewish, but everyone becoming B'nai Noach, recognizing the seven Noahide laws, recognizing the idea of God and Torah. Okay, and looking to the Jews for leadership. Because we didn't do it, right, from the Jewish perspective, we say there's a master plan. God will bring the world to recognition of him and living with that reality. So if we don't do it directly through us, we'll do it indirectly through offshoot religions like Christianity. And Maimonides says this very clearly. The purpose of these religions, albeit now they give us a lot of problems because they think they're in competition with us, is to bring the idea of God into the human consciousness of the world. And that's exactly what they have done. If we don't appreciate how different is the worldview today, you can talk with literally hundreds of millions of people about one God, and people will nod their head and say, absolutely. Okay, he's got parts, Father, Son, that stuff. The Muslims don't have that problem, by the way. But it's a definite, in a positive sense, jump forward for the vast majority of humanity to this recognition. There's also a negative side to it, because now, because we didn't do it directly, we now have competition. Okay, other people who think that their job is to bring the world to recognition of their view of what God is all about. This is called replacement theology. It's an idea that's specifically related to Christianity, but you'll also find very much related to Islam. What's replacement theology? God originally chose the Jews. Any Muslim or Christian will tell you that. They recognize Jewish prophets as prophets, Abraham, right? And Moses, you know, Musa, as they say in Arabic, and Ibrahim and Daoud. And, you know, they recognize all these guys. They're great people. But then a later prophet comes along. In the case of Christianity, it's Jesus, and not just a prophet. He is, from the Christian perspective, you know, a part of God. And from the Islamic perspective, we have Muhammad. We'll talk about Islam later, where that comes in. And they're prophets, and the Jews don't recognize these people. So God rejects us and chooses them instead. So forgetting the Islamic side, the Christian side is, look, Jesus comes along. Jews don't recognize him. The reason why the temple is destroyed and why we go into the diaspora is a punishment for rejecting him. And not forget the killing issue, you know, that deicide stuff. We reject him, so we're punished. Ah, but then there's an interesting question. If the Jews, who used to be God's chosen people, but now Christianity is chosen instead, now we have a New Testament, you still keep the old one because the new one is based on it, but the real binding text is the new one. What is the purpose of the Jew? This is a very important idea in Christian theology up until very recent times. The Christians had a little theological problem, but we have to explain why the Jew continues to exist if his chosen status has now been relegated to us. They came up with an idea called teste veritatis, witness people. Witness people means it's the purpose of the Jew to survive throughout history, okay? To bear witness at the end of days when Jesus comes again that he's the Messiah. And he's also the Jew's is the living example of the whole base of Christianity. We have an Old Testament, we have an old Jew. They're both, one's a physical remnant, one's a textual remnant of the basis of where our religion comes out of. Okay, it doesn't mean Jews are venerated as like ancient people who will have to survive. But the Pope, for literally century after century, the popes in Italy and Vatican kept Jews. Okay, up until World War II, we had the Pope's Jews who survived, of course, the Holocaust or deportations, because some Jews had to survive. And the whole notion of the wandering Jew, which is an idea that appears very much in medieval Europe, of a Jew who wanders around the world, okay, and people have different medieval accounts of spotting this guy with a staff in his hand, you know. He's destined to wander the earth forever and to make it till the end of days, the ultimate example of a witness Jew who wanders from place to place, never being able to find rest anywhere. It's his punishment, but he'll make it to the end of days and ultimately bear witness to the validity of the Christian claims of Jesus, Son of God, and all that stuff. So what we have then is, okay, it's that interesting theologically. Its impact on anti-Semitism is going to be very different now. We're going to have people hating us. I don't want to get into this now, but hating us because they view they're in competition with us, or because we killed their God. Rome will therefore go in the first century from being a pagan empire to a Christian empire, which we call the Byzantine Empire, which doesn't mean one day the Romans wake up and say, hey, like, you know, like the year I can guarantee everyone, January 1st, you're going to wake up, it's going to be the same like every other day, God willing, maybe some Y2K problems, but it's not going to be the world's going to be different, everyone's going to suddenly, you know, you have to figure out how, when you write your checks or how to refer to that 00 thing, what term they're going to use, I don't know, but it's not like the Romans woke up one morning and said, hey, we're Byzantines now. They were still Romans, but now we just have a different religious inclination. Okay, so we're going to deal, the period of time we're going to get into right now of the transition into exile. We're talking about late 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th centuries, the period of the reconstitution of the Sanhedrin and Yavna, the period of the Mishnah, but especially the period of the Talmud. Much of that is taking place in terms of the Roman Empire, what's called the Byzantine Empire, Roman Christian. Okay, and when we go forward, we'll talk a little bit more about the implications of that. Any questions? Someone had a hand raised? Yes.
Yeah, actually I had a comment. Back when there was the people were coming from, there was like a Christian rally going on, and then we went to kind of approach these people, and they were Jews for Jesus, actually. And there was like a big Christian crowd, and we got to talk to a couple of the people, and they were saying that actually they wanted the people of Israel, the Jews, to come back because it was to fulfill their prophecy. And
right.
If we came back here, then
Right. It's interesting the point you're bringing up about like how the Christian world views the Jews today. It's definitely evolved. Whereas the Pope, this current Pope, you know, John Paul, saying the Jews have a place, you know, and thank you, Pope, for saying that. You know, like you have a place. Before you're like, damn, now you have a place. Amongst the fundamentalist Christians, the idea is obviously they believe in the Bible. The Catholic Church is not as into the Bible as obviously the Protestants have been or the fundamentalists. And the idea is they believe in the scenarios, the Jewish scenario of Messiah. Okay, our idea of coming is their idea of second coming of the Messiah. And I always say to Christians, look, let's forget the missionary work. I'll tell you what, you let me bring all the Jews back to Torah. The Messiah will come, and we'll see who's right. And meanwhile, let's put a little wager down, you know. Like, I'll bet you $1,000 it's not Jesus. But anyway, that's a side point. But you're right, that's 100%. So you have, well, we can get like a bookie deal going here. You actually have a very interesting idea where you get a lot of fundamentalist Christians coming to Israel, very pro the idea of Jews coming back. They have their agenda. It's not just they love the Jewish people. Okay, I don't want to get into the whole class on modern Christian attitudes towards Judaism, which are, to be fair, very different to a large extent than Christian attitudes of 2,000 years ago, but you're right, they do have an agenda, and they'd love us all to come back, because then they think Jesus will come, and then we'll finally recognize the error of our ways and you know, all convert to Christianity. Okay, so, you know, we'll see. Yeah?
What's the next section?
The next section we're going into right now, I want to talk about the transition into exile, in terms of just quick review, just to back up a little teeny bit. We talked about destruction of the Second Temple. Remember Yochanan ben Zakkai? Remember he has himself smuggled outside. He asked that Yavna be spared with the sages. We're going into a period of time called the Yavna period. The Yavna period, the first place where the Sanhedrin is going to be reconstituted after the destruction of the Second Temple, is going to be in Yavna. And it's a very important period of time, and the challenges facing the Jewish people are very significant, and this idea of the challenges and the adaptation that Judaism has to take in the next couple hundred years is like the major theme. We don't realize like what a big deal this was, how difficult this was. We're talking about once we get to the destruction of Second Temple, and within a couple of hundred years after, any normative Judaism in the land of Israel is going to cease to exist. Obviously, the destruction of Second Temple, we lose the major focus of Jewish observance, the temple, albeit as corrupted as it was and whatever, it's gone. No more high priests. We already have no legitimate kings from way before that period of time. Okay, we do still have, for several centuries after, a Sanhedrin with a Nasi, a president, and an Av Beit Din, right, the head of the court, that's court administrator, those things are also going to cease. By the 4th century, it's pretty much everything's going to be gone. And therefore, the challenge of the Jewish leadership at the period of time, which is purely rabbinic now, no priests, no kings, is going to be to pass on, first of all, first and foremost, to pass on Torah, the oral tradition, and to create a version of Judaism, you know, 3.11 updated, you know, to create a version of Judaism based on what it's supposed to be in its ideal, yet lacking all of the basic components, especially things like temple, whatever, that will enable the Jews to have a portable, not to say religion, but portable Judaism that they can take with them wherever they go. It is something that is one of the, it's something we don't begin to appreciate how amazing it is, the foresight of some of these people, and how significant it is, because if they didn't do this, we wouldn't be here. And it's also, again, very important to always keep in the back of your mind when looking at all of this period of time forward, is how different the Judaism we have today is from the Judaism of 2,000 years ago. Not having a temple, all of that stuff. We don't appreciate how amazing it is we have a religion which is in so many ways different and daily observance from what we used to do, yet we still have it as vibrant, and that all the Jewish people have kept it, didn't split. We have offshoots, but we don't have a major schism like, you know, Eastern, Western Church, you know, Sunni, Shiites. We don't have that in Judaism. You have people who go off, but it's not like there's major disagreement as to what Judaism is about, and let's, you know, divide the religion. That it stays together for thousands of years and adapts, and that we create the support mechanisms to keep it going is quite amazing. And it's always worthwhile to keep that in the back of our minds, to realize that how abnormal that is in history, how unique it is, and what an important aspect of Jewish survival it is. So we have Yochanan ben Zakkai comes to Yavna. His job, he's like, you're talking about major trauma therapy. You know, you're talking about dealing with, you know, God forbid, you hear about like some nut goes into a school and shoots up the school. They bring in all the shrinks to talk to all the kids because everyone's traumatized. We're talking about a man whose responsibility it is to keep the Jewish people from falling to pieces. The temple's destroyed, tremendous slaughter. This Yavna period is very important. He, by the way, abdicates his position very quickly and gives it over to Rabban Gamliel. Okay, why Rabban Gamliel? Because Rabban Gamliel is the descendant of Hillel. Okay, the house of Hillel, which is the house of King David. It's the royal lineage of King David, and also that sort of hereditary position of the Nasi. Okay, because Rabban Gamliel, they want to keep that. He's one of the last vestiges of Jewish nobility and something that people can look up to. And it is these two guys, Yochanan ben Zakkai and Rabban Gamliel, who put into place much of what is normative Judaism today, all of these takanot, about, like, what do we do now? We don't have a temple. What do we do on Sukkot? You know, Lulav Esrog. Do we do it? Yes. All those things are rabbinic, by the way, today. Much of the stuff we do. Prayer. The final closing of what is formalized prayer. All the stuff takes place in Yavna. All the things that were designed to replace all the things that were missing so that we can have a daily functioning Jewish life. And also, very important, so that we can remember what normal Jewish life is about. As I mentioned before, when we talked about the men of the Great Assembly, the idea of formalized prayer, right, replaces temple service, so we don't forget that that's what's supposed to be, that we do things on different holidays, you know, like the Passover Seder, all the stuff comes into place then, the formalization of all of this, all the different takanot, how we keep the different holidays, what we pray, what we do, now that we don't have normative Judaism the way it should be in its ideal state. Yeah, Max.
So, when people say that Jewish law hasn't changed, doesn't that get right to the point where you just said that it does change?
Excellent question. Jewish law, we have to, the words change, adopt, you have to understand, Jewish law definitely evolves within certain limitations based on certain immutable parameters, based on certain principles that do not change. So within, obviously, if it was so rigid that obviously the rabbis, the big change, the big issue is the power, the authority of the rabbis to interpret and adapt Jewish law within certain parameters.
Not only their authority, but
and it's their duty, of course. Without that, we wouldn't have Judaism today. So you have to be very careful between saying that and saying I can do whatever I like. When we get to talking about, no, I'm not saying you do that at all. But when we talk about like conservative Judaism much later and reform and things like that and other splinter groups, even the Karaites that we'll get to within a class, we'll see that there are certain red lines beyond which no mainstream Orthodox, as they call them nowadays, Jew will cross. And the rabbis knew that they had certain authority to adapt and make fences around the Torah and put takanot in place, rabbinic decrees, but beyond certain lines, they don't go. Yes?
Right, so you said there's no temple, no priests, etc., etc. And then there's two rabbis who are like now having to like adapt to all these things, given like the rise of Christianity, mm-hmm. Missionaries, etc., etc. And like, obviously, you can't really understand the situation, but there's no temple,
right,
etc., etc. Now, what those two people did then, is completely like in that time frame, having had the concept of what I'm saying. So they should obviously made certain decrees and changed the life of Jewish law in certain ways which is not relevant to us now. I mean, mm-hmm. the rabbis of today are even very different.
Right.
It's like a different circumstance. I mean, the circumstances then, like everything you just said, is like, you know, it's like, you know, like, they probably were so defiant due to, like, you know, assimilating and being given to Christianity and this and that. You know, and that's an argument to believe where a lot of the lack of this, like, sort of come from, the developed, like.
Okay. So Paul's asking an interesting question about, like, maybe it's not relevant today. It was done as a, first of all, the fear was not Christianity. It was not a big draw for the Jews. The fear was, how do we function as a Jewish people without basic Jewish institutions? The question is, it's not a class on adaptation of Jewish law. It's a very interesting topic, which is beyond the scope of what I'm doing. But there's a few basic ideas. First of all, we're talking about people of tremendous foresight, and the ideas, we say, our traditional perspective on it is the ideas are always relevant. Even though the situation, the challenges change, and by the way, believe it or not, technology changes, but the challenges they have to deal with then are very much the challenges overwhelming that we deal with today. That's number one. And there's a basic, by the way, rule, which is very important in understanding Jewish law, that a later court cannot uproot the decrees of an earlier court unless they are greater in number and in wisdom. Which never happens, by the way, because the further we get away from Mount Sinai, the murkier the transmission process begins. The level of people's understanding of Torah does not go up, it goes down. And the point being is, this is a very important point, because there are certainly in any number of takanot, which to us today seems sort of irrelevant. I'm certainly not saying they are. But there's a bigger principle here that's going on, is the idea that although there are takanot, in theory, decrees that maybe could be changed, certainly we are not in a position spiritually or knowledge of law to change them, and it's opening Pandora's box to uproot things. It's a very important thing to focus on. I don't want to get into this more, but if you think about it, once you say, little thing, let's get rid of it, one more thing, and before you know it, they dump the whole system. And believe me, history has proved that to be 100% true. When we get into later Jewish splinter sects that come off, we'll see exactly that's what happens. So it wasn't like just paranoia. It was how to create. It was a creative process, not just a defensive process. Again, I don't want to go into more because I could spend a whole class talking about it, but it's how to create. It's a huge topic, very interesting. But how to create a functioning version of Jewish lifestyle that keeps us in touch with the way we should be ideally and keeps us living as Jews on a day-to-day basis. And again, the more you study Jewish law and you study the history of the period and the personalities involved, the more you appreciate what the foresight and the creativity of these people. Okay. So remember, we talked about the Sanhedrin is moving from place to place over several centuries. The Sanhedrin is going to move around until it ends up in Tiberias. I'll go back and review all the locations. I'll read you the exact quote from the Talmud. It gives you all the locations later. But we're talking about, I want to jump ahead now, because the Sanhedrin is not necessary. It doesn't immediately reconstitute itself in Yavne. It takes a long time for the Sanhedrin to reconstitute itself. During the reigns of Trajan and Hadrian, which correspond to the Bar Kokhba revolt and a few years after, and certainly many years before, there's a lot of persecutions of Jews and hostility. The Sanhedrin can't sit for many, many decades. It doesn't function normally. So we're talking about there's always a body of rabbis around making decisions, but there's not always a functioning Sanhedrin. Okay? I want to jump ahead to one personality who's absolutely fundamental to understand this period of time, one of the great personalities of Jewish history, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Okay, Judah the Prince. Okay, who lives in the second to early, very early third centuries of the Common Era, who's a descendant of the house of Hillel. He has a very unique combination of attributes that give him very unusual powers, and plus he lives at a period of time where he has a unique opportunity to do something, which in hindsight is very, very resourceful and fundamental to the survival of the Jewish people. Obviously, he's a Torah scholar. He is a man of tremendous abilities. Okay, he's also a man of, seems to be very diplomatic. His leadership skills speak quite very good. Very strong personality, ideally suited to be a leader of the Jewish people. A man of tremendous personal wealth, very good, because to be wealthy and powerful and also be on the right track puts him in a unique position to wheel and deal and do what needs to get done, not just with the Jews in the land of Israel, but with the Roman authorities. And so great is he, as a matter of fact, that we just call him Rebbe. When you guys hear the title Rebbe, not the Rebbe to mean Lubavitcher Rebbe, but when you hear the title Rebbe, okay, you know we're talking about Yehuda Hanasi. He is the central figure. He's in the whole story of the creation of the Mishnah, which is a very significant story in Jewish history. It's right here in our little 300 years into transition to exile. We have the Mishnah compiled here. It says in the bottom, number 3, 200 CE. He's the main figure involved. if you so Yehuda HaNasi, by the way, if you look in Avodah Zorah, which is on 10a and b, and in Bereishis Rabbah 67:6, it talks about, there's two sources where it talks about Rebbe's unique relationship with the Roman emperor who's called Antoninus. Okay, now we know the problem we always have as Jewish historians is figuring out who are the characters being mentioned in the Jewish sources vis-a-vis the characters we know of in secular history. Like when it talks about, as I mentioned before, Ahasuerus. Is that Ataraxerxes? We don't know. We're not sure. Which pharaoh are we talking about? We're not sure. The problem with Antoninus is there's a whole series of Roman emperors called the Antonines. Okay? And Rebbe, and this could be a composite character. We're not sure. It's probably, there's a number of different Roman emperors it could be. One is Antoninus Pius, who I think ruled until about the year 161. Okay? His, I believe it is, son-in-law and nephew, I think it was his relative and his son-in-law, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, see, same name, Antoninus, succeeds him as emperor. Okay? And both these people, from the Jewish perspective, unlike people like Trajan and Hadrian, who were vicious oppressors of the Jews and anti-Semites, these guys, for most part, most of these Antonines, seem to have been much more tolerant and open to the Jewish people than the previous ones. So they basically relax all the decrees that had been in place. Now, we talked about Bar Kokhba, and the decrees were put in place by Hadrian, forbidding teaching of Torah, and all the things that the Greeks tried to do during the Maccabean story. So we see during the time of Antoninus Pius, Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, that the Romans sort of, as we say, chill out a little bit. And the relationship with the Jews improves, and this gives the Jewish people a window of opportunity to act. And this is right, we have a unique combination of factors. A window of opportunity caused by change in the leadership of Rome, more tolerant, a person in a tremendous position of leadership, Rabbi Judah Yehuda HaNasi, the prince. And he, by the way, according to Jewish tradition, if you look in these sources, it says that he had a relationship with Antoninus. They had a tunnel dug between his mansion and Antoninus' palace. This is a bit enigmatic because we know that no Roman emperor lives in the land of Israel, but we know that people, that they did pass through here. So the stories talked about in the Talmud could be that for a period of time there was a Roman emperor visiting here and struck up a relationship with Yehuda HaNasi. We don't know. But again, the point of the story is not so much how accurate it is historically, but to show the point that Yehuda HaNasi is in good standing with the Romans, and he uses his authority to do something which is very, very important. He's going to come up with a definitive version of the Oral Torah, which we're going to call the Mishnah. Okay, now the Mishnah is very important to understand. We talked about, this is fundamental. Judaism, we say, oral law, written law. First thing given is oral law at Mount Sinai to Moses, 613 commandments and the principles how to apply them. That's what living as a Jew is all about. That's what's passed from generation to generation. Okay, in Perkei Avot, it talks about Moses gets it and gives it to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great assembly, etc. That's what's being passed down from generation to generation. There's an actual prohibition in the Torah against writing down the Mishnah, a definitive version of the Mishnah. Why? Because it's supposed to be fluid. It's supposed to, the principles stay the same, but the application and the examples you use to illustrate are supposed to adapt with the times. Meaning, in an ideal state, if all the bad things that happened to us hadn't happened to us, today when you'd be sitting in yeshiva learning the laws of damages, anyone learn the laws of damages in Jewish law? You learn about from a fire, a pit, a goring ox. You know, an ox that gores, you know, like bullfights, you know, sticks them in the matador, that kind of guy. If we had the mission in its ideal state, you'd be learning from a electric shock, a car that hit someone, and who knows. You'd have modern tech, the principles would be the same, but the examples that we'd be using would be modern, contemporary. That is only possible when you have strong central authority and a clearly transmitted oral Torah. Yehuda HaNasi realizes that the temple has already been destroyed at this period of time for like 13 centuries. Okay, it's not going to be rebuilt anytime in the near future. The situation is not getting better for the Jews, it's getting worse. The real diaspora of the Jews is increasing. Central authority may not exist. Therefore, if, God forbid, the Sanhedrin ceases to sit or the chain of transmission is broken in Israel, the Oral Torah will be gone, Jewish people will disappear. God forbid. So he violates the negative commandment, don't write down the Oral Torah. It's called Eitz Lasos Hashem. It's an emergency measure. Meaning, to save Torah, he violates a smaller prohibition of Torah. He had the authority to do this. Tremendous piece of hindsight. He's going to basically put together, get over... We said Jewish tradition, he gets over 1,000 1,000 Tannaim. Remember the Tannaim we're talking about from 10 BCE till 200, which is right around the end of his lifetime? Okay, he's going to basically get all the biggest rabbis he can get his hands on and collect from all of them all of their traditions about the oral Torah that they received that can be traced all the way down to Moses at Mount Sinai. Okay, and he puts it together. He edits it. A lot of stuff is edited out of it. A huge amount of stuff is edited out of it. Okay, he puts together what's called the Mishnah. Okay, which means to teach. Okay, Mishnah. And it's divided into six basic segments dealing with six basic areas of Jewish law. Okay, which is, it's important to know the six basic segments. First of all, you have Zroim, which is dealing with agricultural law. Then you have Moed, which is dealing with Jewish holidays. Then you have Nashim, which is dealing with the laws of marriage, divorce, women. Then you have Nazikin, which is Jewish laws of damages. Then you have Kodshim, which is the laws of sacrifices, temple worship. And Tahara, which is the law. The last is dealing with laws of purity, Tumah and Tahara, an idea which is very far from us today. But those six segments, more or less, are Shisha Sedra Mishnah, we call it, the six volumes of the Mishnah, which is a cryptic codification of the oral law, put together by the Tanaim, organized by Yehuda Hanasi, around the year 200 is the year we like to use, it's not exact date, in an attempt to keep the oral law from being forgotten. Okay, that's what the Mishnah is. Very important to understand. It's in Hebrew. Okay. And it's put together in Tzipori, the last 17 years of Yehuda Hanasi's life. Okay, he moves to Tzipori, which is a very beautiful place. It's a nice place up there in the Galil. You can go up there. There's a very interesting archaeological site there. And that is where the Mishnah is compiled. By the way, Yehuda Hanasi himself is buried in a giant mountain crypt area. A very interesting place. I was just there a few weeks ago, called Beit Sha'arim, which is the hollowed out all these catacombs into the side of a mountain. And his tomb they actually found with his name on it and everything. So all the tombs have been robbed and they're big sarcophagi, you know, big stone coffins that all broken into and everything's been scattered out of them. No bones lying around. It's all disintegrated. But that's where he was buried. And that's where many of the great scholars of that time were buried in. They wanted to be near a big tzaddik like him. They had themselves buried there. But Tzipori, up north, around this period of time, around the year 200, a little before actually, is where the Mishnah is finally put together. Okay, so we have, and with the closing of the Mishnah, and there are other things that were kept outside. We're going to see we have things called Brises and Tosefta. There's other Jewish sources that were edited out, still have power in Jewish law, but not the same authority as the Mishnah has. Okay, that's the end of the period of the Tanaim. So it's a good period of time to keep in your mind, from 10 to around 200, corresponds to, right, we're talking about 130 years after the destruction of the Second Temple, when the Jewish people are definitely going into decline. It's still pagan world, by the way. We have Christianity, still a little splinter sect. Okay, this is when Yehuda HaNasi seizes this opportunity, puts together the Mishnah. Okay, so if you look at our little charts here, you have, just a quick review here, we have our 1, 2, 3 pieces of Torah. We're going to get to the fourth right now, which is the Talmud. One we're talking about is the five books of Moses, remember? Completed right before Moses dies, before the Jewish people enter the land of Israel. Two is the men of the great assembly, putting together the books of the prophets and the writings, and sealing the Bible into the 24 books we have today. That's the written Torah. Three is the first part of the oral Torah we have, right? The Mishnah over here, compiled 200 CE. Okay, so far so good? Any questions? Are we clear? Okay. So what I want to talk about now is the last little thing before we flip over. Today we'll get to the end. This is the real transition period, Talmud. The period of time from 200 till about 500, I'm rounding off the dates here, is going to be the period of time of the Amoraim. Okay, remember Tanoim, Tana is one who teaches 10 to 200, 10 BCE till 200. Amoraim, okay, and there are two groups of Amoraim. An Amora is one who says, another Aramaic term. The Amoraim are going to live in two places. They're going to be living in the land of Israel, okay, until about the middle of the 4th century, there's Amoraim in Israel. But the period of the Amoraim really ends around the year 500 with Ravina, the one of the last of Amoraim, with the closing of the Babylonian Talmud. So for all practical purposes, you want to remember Amoraim, think 200 to 500. The Amoraim in the land of Israel, we're going to see, don't make it as long. They're not called Amoraim because the situation in Israel is worse. Okay, but it's pretty easy. You got a 210-year period of Tanoim, and then you have a 300-year period of Amoraim. I mentioned this before. Tanoim are going to always have the title Rebbe, and an Amora is going to have the title Rav. Okay? The Amoraim are the guys who are going to put together the Talmud. Okay? And it's very important to spend a few minutes talking about the Talmud. You could spend weeks talking about the Talmud. You could spend your whole life learning it. You could spend 10 lifetimes learning it. Talmud is such a central and basic book in Judaism. First of all, what is it? Why did it come into place? All of these things we see are happening because of the declining situation in the Jewish world. Lack of central authority and the fear that the transmission process will be broken. And as we get further away from Mount Sinai, as I mentioned before, the details get fuzzy. The Mishnah, as important as it was, later on in Jewish history, within the few centuries after, well, by the way, the situation gets very bad. In the Roman world, in the 3rd century, which is the first century of the period of the Amoraim, is a terrible period of time in the Roman Empire. Chaos is always bad for everyone involved in the Roman Empire. For the Jews, it means the land of Israel economically declines further. You have more lawlessness. Central authority is much, not just Roman central authority, Jewish central authority is much harder to maintain. And therefore, the ability to study and pass things on accurately is going to become much more difficult. Okay? Now, of course, a good percentage of the Jews of the world are already in Babylon. They don't have that problem. But it's just good to know what's going on in the Roman Empire at the time. This is, by the way, just to step outside of Jewish history, after the end of Pax Romana, which we say is about, 120 or so, the end of the period of time, from 80 BC to 120 CE, and certainly by the 3rd century, the Roman Empire is going to go into continual decline. There's a couple of periods of time when it will revive slightly, but it's going to go down, 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 until by the 5th century, late 5th century, it disappears. So all of this is going to have an impact on the Jews still living in the Roman Empire, and Israel's, remember, is still part of this Roman Empire. Okay. So basically, we have the Mishnah is not enough. Okay, it's too cryptic. It wasn't clear enough for people to understand and to pass on accurately, so these rabbis at this period of time comment on the Mishnah. The Talmud, more or less, it's much more than this, but the Talmud is more or less an explanation of the text of the Mishnah, how to apply it. Okay, very important. And it's in Aramaic. I'm saying there's two Talmuds. There's a Bavli and a Yerushalmi. Okay, Bavli means Babylonian, Yerushalmi means Jerusalem. Ironically, Jerusalem Talmud is not put together in Jerusalem, it's put together in Tiberias, which is the last place the Sanhedrin sits. By the middle of the 4th century, the Sanhedrin is going to be gone. Okay, the last place they're going to sit is in Tiberias. They're going to redact, finish collecting all the material and putting it together. So we have our two Talmuds. The Jerusalem Talmud is much shorter and much harder to understand than the Babylonian Talmud because it had like a century and a half less time to put it together, meaning the editing had to be much more rushed. Why? As I explained before, the situation in Israel is just much worse. Babylon, which is outside of Rome, Persian Empire, more stable, larger Jewish community, more prosperous, less problems, they're going to have more leisure, so to speak, to do a better job putting it together. What we learn in yeshiva today, people learn Yerushalmi, as we call it, but the main text that the Jewish people learn today in yeshivas is the Babylonian Talmud. And it's more than just an application of the details of the Jewish law as expounded in the Mishnah. It's the encyclopedia of all Jewish existence. Any of you guys learned the Talmud yet? You started learning it yet? Not yet? First of all, it's a little harder because it's in Aramaic. Remember, Aramaic is, along with Greek, the lingua franca of the ancient world. Certainly in Babylon it was the language, which is related to Hebrew. They're both Semitic languages, Western Semitic languages. But nonetheless, if you know Hebrew well, you can learn Aramaic a lot more easily, but it's different. Okay? But it's more than just an explanation of what's going on in the Mishnah. It's the Encyclopedia of Jewish Existence. It has a huge amount of discussion of Jewish law. It also has all kinds of, it's sort of like it just flows into many other side discussions. A lot of Agadita, which is, I love Agadita, it's very interesting. Agadita are all kinds of stories that are not just there to entertain you. And now we take a break from the legal tedium to tell you an interesting story. Rather, the Agadita is illustrating a very important point of Jewish worldview. It's unbelievable how interesting the Agadita is. Very important. Okay, all kinds of stuff in it. It's health information, science information, you name it, it's in there. And it's vital to the Jewish people because, first of all, how we apply Jewish law today, no one, I hope everyone knows this, very important. No one opens up a Bible and says, the Bible says this is Jewish law. Like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, you knocked out my tooth, I knocked out yours. Jewish law is never applied by reading sentences from the Bible. It's also never applied, by the way, from reading sentences from the Mishnah. Okay?
The way we learn Jewish law, it's called Hora'ah in a nutshell. Again, this is not all of you should make it to the Smicha program. You will do many weeks of what is certainly one of the most interesting topics in Judaism, how is Jewish law applied. You learn out, you follow a Rishon is a rabbi who lived up until the mid-15th century. You follow a Rishon's interpretation of one of the opinions in the Talmud. Okay, a Rishon, why we get to the Rishonim, I'll explain why we follow them. But the Talmud is the book that we use. Again, you can't open up the Talmud and say the Talmud says this is the Jewish law. You have to follow the opinion of a Rishon's interpretation of the Talmud. Okay, we'll understand that later. But that is where we learn Jewish law out of. Now, what's most interesting about the Talmud, and people always like to say this, is if you look at it, there's thousands of pages of Talmud. If you learn a blot a day, as we call it, daf yomi, which is two sides of a page of Talmud, pages of Talmud go like 36 A and B. 37 A and B, two sides. It takes you 7 years to learn through all of Talmud. So it's a big thing. I mean, I believe the Babylonian Talmud has 36 tractates in it, and it's not everything in the Mishnah is commented on the Babylonian Talmud, because it's in Babylon. Some of the information that's related to Jerusalem is not in there, and what's going on in the temple. The Yerushalmi, I believe, although being shorter, I think is 39 tractates. Okay, so they cover most of the Mishnah, with certain big exceptions, the things that are missing. But if you look on every page of the Talmud, you see, as big as it is, on every single page the rabbis are arguing. Every page. You know, they have this term pilpul. You know, like, pilpul means the give and take of Talmudic exegesis. You know, you're going through it and trying to learn out the law. It has sort of a negative connotation. You know, look at these guys argue about nothing. And some of the arguments have absolutely no basis in reality. Like, these are situations that will never happen. Not in a million years. What's going on? How can you say there's like Jewish laws, like mainstream Jewish law, and the rabbis can't agree on anything back then? How do you expect us to agree on anything today? So just a couple of points. Again, it's a big topic. But first of all, the reason why rabbis would argue about things that may not have any application is they're trying to get to truth. Even in an abstract way, we want to understand a principle. And principles always have importance, even if they're not applied. And Jews are obsessed. One of the major things that I learned when I came to Yeshiva, and I think all of you probably appreciate, is that a true Torah Jew who is interested in knowing what reality is and doing the right thing. Not the ego stuff. I'm not afraid of change. I want to know what the reality is. Even if it has no application, I've got to get to the principle, because reality is what Judaism is all about. Ultimate reality being God. But not only that, in terms of the discussions and the arguments going on, it's not a question of everything is argued on, everything's open. That's a very important point, because when we get to talking about offshoots of Judaism, like the conservative movement, it's going to be a really big point. The point is that the rabbis are arguing on every page, and almost everything they argue about is incredibly small detail. No, you don't see any argument, can you eat pork or not? Can I light a fire on the Sabbath? Am I allowed to ride my chariot? Okay, you know, none of those, by virtue of the fact that all the disagreements are, virtue of that exception, on very small points, some of which are not even relevant to any application, what does it say about the big things? They're all agreed on. They're even not brought into the discussion because there's no discussion about them because everyone agrees. We have to keep this in mind. There are red lines. I was talking about rabbinic authority to do things. There are red lines beyond which no Jew ever crosses in mainstream, traditional, whatever you want to call it, Orthodox Judaism. Outside of that, yes, you do have a range of opinions, which is why Judaism in the Orthodox world, which I always find funny, people think it's monolithic, it's the most diverse segment of the Jewish population is the religious world. There are a range of opinions to which you can follow in any number of things, in terms of keeping kashrut and in terms of what you wear and you name it. But there are red lines beyond which all Jews, we're talking about way after, 1500 years after the closing of the Talmud, no one disagrees on them. Is this clear to people? Very important point. Yeah, Max, a question.
Yeah, but I mean, what people in the Nazi did, he went in and negative commandment and broke it, and what he thought was an effort to say.
First of all, it's not one of the 613 commandments is thou shalt not write down the oral law. It's not one of the 613 commandments of the Torah. And that's, by the way, that's an extreme measure. That's an Eis L'Asos Hashem measure. That's like an absolute vital. He was going against an accepted principle within Judaism. By the way, it's very important you mention that. I forgot to say. Doesn't mean, by the way, that you couldn't take notes on the oral law. You have to keep it secret, like it's a secret handshake, you know, like the you could keep notes on it, no problem. I'm sure every big rabbi had his own personal notes from his Rebbe, who has it from his Rebbe, has it from his Rebbe to Moses. But you didn't want to come out with a definitive version for everyone to have. Okay, so you have to understand what he was doing. There are extreme cases when you can violate a principle to save all Jewish law. But we have to be at an incredibly high level to do that. You can be sure when he did it. Yeah?
Okay, yeah.
No, he did succeed. He definitely succeeded. The Mishnah, without the Mishnah, he wouldn't have the Talmud. But it's just that the Talmud needed further elucidation. So it wasn't he didn't succeed.
Well,
it's that the... It's that the Jewish people's situation continued to deteriorate to the point where it wasn't enough.
Okay,
so fine. And then the rabbis had the foresight to realize we have to comment on the Mishnah further. So the point is, but it's a very huge topic. What gives people authority to do things? You have to be on a very certain level to do it. Again, I can't get into it now, but it's a huge topic of who has the authority to do what in what circumstances. That's one of the most unusual cases of what Yehuda HaNasi does. Now, so what do we have? Therefore, when you open a page of the Talmud, okay, you'll see. There's a little section of it called the Mishnah, which is in Hebrew. If you know your Hebrew and Aramaic, you'll notice one's in Hebrew. And then it goes into sometimes a very lengthy, discussion, which is often digresses for pages into something totally different. Okay, that'll be the Talmud. Now, later on, we'll see the Talmud itself, because of the continuing spread of diaspora, the continuing decline in the level of scholarship, also is not going to be enough. So we're going to have a lot of people commenting on it afterwards. Most important, and this is much later in Jewish history, we'll talk about him. If you look at your page of Talmud here, in the middle you have the text, Mishnah, Gemara, as it's called, Gemara, Talmud, used interchangeably. And on the sides, on the inside of every page of Talmud, will be Rashi. Okay? Rashi, the great medieval commentator on the Bible, as I've been told, correctly pronounced from Troyes, right? I got it now. From the Riviera area. Rashi puts together, before they had the Cannes Film Festival there, and it was not so exotic back then, Rashi puts together an amazing commentary further explaining the Talmud, without which we wouldn't be able to understand the Talmud today, which shows you how much we've declined.